It took me a while to wrap my mind around that, because you have to kind of be open-minded to be even call yourself a socialist in America. So people are usually very socially liberal and socialist. And when you say you're socialist, you kind of wrap that all in there. But labor is like, I mean, I just think of it as like the union boss of the police, the union boss of the teachers, and the union boss of like Teamsters, whatever. Like if they had a party. And are they in it for themselves, or are they in it for the workers, or are they in it to keep themselves in a job? Like, that's what labor is to me.
Welcome to World Beat. I am George Collins. I hope all you good folks out there are doing well, whenever and wherever you happen to be tuning in. This time, it's time to go back across the pond. The United Kingdom could find itself in a buzzsaw once again as British PM Boris Johnson's numbers are tanking, the next round of elections loom on the horizon, and many of these underlying cultural realignments that resulted in Brexit and all the fallout really haven't been resolved in the past while. Now, in our past interview with Neil Scott, we rehashed the 2014 Scottish independence referendum, and today I'd like to look ahead to some new realignments taking place in the Scottish political scene. And joining me on World Beat to do this is Kat Carey. She is the National Secretary for the SNP Socialists and the Women's Officer for the Aberdeen Independence Movement, as well as the co-host of the Talking Sense podcast. Kat, thank you very much for coming on World Beat.
George, thanks for having me on.
Of course. So I want to start with a bit of background on you, because you actually were born stateside out there in Wisconsin. What was it like growing up out around Milwaukee?
It was good. Like, it was a peaceful upbringing. You know, I'm the oldest of four daughters, so we didn't live far away from downtown Milwaukee, maybe like a 15-minute drive. We only lived about an hour away from Chicago, and I grew up on a farm, which was, you know, kind of failing. It ended up when I was about 11, my family sold the family farm to a developer who turned it into a subdivision. So that was interesting, but I got to grow up on a farm until then. And then, you know, my parents moved to a subdivision down the road. And when I was 19, I mean, it was a great upbringing, but you know, I always wanted to travel. I was always, you know, was always a bit of a misfit, you know, waifs and strays or whatever they were. but when I was 19, I enlisted in the Navy and got out of there. But it was a great upbringing. It was just, you know, didn't have much money, didn't have many options, didn't really know what I wanted to do with myself. So, except for see the world. So join the Navy.
Mm-hmm. And so did both of your folks work the farm, or did they turn to other careers after selling it? How did that go?
So it was in my mother's family. It was actually, so the one neat thing is I grew up in a farmhouse that was built in like 1910. So for here, that's not old, but in America, that's very old. And to have like all of your ancestors, like great, 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 greats up on the wall, because they all lived there and they all worked that land. It was really neat because my mom's parents were very young because they're farm people. My grandpa was like 43 when I was born. But they taught me a lot. Where was I getting at with that? my grandpa, his generation, but not that much older than me, they all had jobs with like the telephone company, the electric company, aside from working on the farm. And that's kind of how, and then my mom's generation, my uncle kind of went to university for agriculture, but by that time they were renting out the fields and, you know, we'd only have livestock every once in a while. They call them hobby farms. They don't call them that here. So when I go, we kind of had a hobby farm. And they're like, what is that? I'm like, you have your career and then you have like a cow, or you have some chickens, or you have, in our case, we'd have pigs every once in a while to raise them. And, you know, maybe your neighbor did something else. Like my cousins had turkeys. So that was our hobby farm, but we got to live on the farm still, even though, you know, a different farmer did the fields.
So with this being a generational piece of property here. When it was time where it had to be sold, I mean, how did that affect the family? How did your parents respond to that?
I mean, it was sad. It was really, I mean, I remember, like, I'm one of the only ones that remembers it from my sisters and I, but my mom and I were like really, really upset. And, you know, we pulled down one of the barns that we could use the timber. So, you know, there was stuff like that, but it was my mom's family. So, like, my dad was very practical. Okay, we need to do this and that. And, you know, my mom's family is very practical too, but you just kind of get on with it. It was like, it was the fact that the taxes would have eaten up everything and we would have lost the farm anyways. We were selling it at a point, and it was my great grandma selling it. It wasn't, you know, us getting any money off of it. It was just necessary, you know, like, we moved in with my dad's parents in like South Milwaukee for like a year while my parents looked for a house. It was very, I didn't enjoy it. I really miss growing up on that farm. I could still drive by and see like the old farmhouse in the middle of a subdivision of like subdivision houses. It's very strange.
What year was that they had to sell it?
Let's see. I think I was 11. So it was in the 90s. It was in the early 90s.
Yeah, you know, and the reason I ask is because I think about, at least in the American cultural context, the idea of, like, you know, the heartland and when exactly a lot of cracks start to form between. I mean, I'm from also out in the sticks, but a different region from Idaho, right? So I think about, like, flyover country is what we call it. I don't know what y'all would call it back there. But it seems to be, like, around the 80s especially is when so much of the identity of what it means to be American is centered on, like, the cities and the coast and, you know, California especially. And now I think in the current political context is there's now talk about return to, like, a quote real America. And I've always wondered if the seeds for that are sown around this time when there is a real fallout in the heartland. Looking back, is that, do you think that was something that your folks got caught up in? And how do you think that kind of affected their outlook on the country?
Well, I think my dad worked at a factory and my mom was a stay-at-home mom. So, like, these decisions were being made by, like, my grandparents, my great, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And the whole family. So it was more of an intergenerational thing. Maybe my parents were just like, yeah, this is what needs to happen. You know, like, sometimes you're in these, like, family things and it's all kind of out of your control. I will say, like, my grandpa is, he's like an FDR Democrat, if that makes sense. Like, mm-hmm. Even though McCarthy came from Wisconsin. So Milwaukee had three socialist mayors and we're very proud of it. And there was always that, like, no, actually, like, maybe it wasn't when I was growing up that you could say socialism as much, but you were like, no, it's actually okay to get federal subsidies to keep the small family farm going. And, you know, there was also this, like, responsibility part in it of, like, one kid from every generation always went and was, like, an alderman or councilman at the city council. Like, probably because there wasn't enough work to do at the farm, but, like, it kind of became a point of pride with the family. And, like, my great aunt, my grandpa's older sister, she was, like, a clerk at the city hall for ages and ages. So, mm-hmm. I mean, all those kind of, I mean, my husband tells me I was raised in, like, the 19th century, because it's so old fashioned the way I was raised compared to a lot of Americans. So I don't know if it was really in with all the other things going on at the time, but I mean, it was in the middle of neoliberalism, right? Like, everything was going to a big corporation and, you know, we weren't well off enough to be able to fight back the tide, you know, we're just pieces in it.
Well, it's a fight that continues to this day. Like I said, I know a lot of kind of smaller farmers like that. And it is, like, even some of the most hardcore libertarian among them will still talk about things like the farm bill. And it's like, look, if we didn't have that, like, we'd be underwater 5 years ago, especially with, you know, as the Chinese market has really ramped up for, you know, soybeans, of course, is the big one. But you could talk about this in a lot of different crops as well. It's a it seems like a very common trait that, like, yeah, a lot of farmers are very live and let live, just let me do my thing, but also understanding that, you know, Washington's got something for them that they don't want going away.
Yeah. They used to rotate crops. Like I remember that growing up, is they would have soybeans and winter wheat, or, you know, and now it's all corn there, all corn all over. I mean, I haven't been back in years and years, but it's all corn.
No, it ain't changed much, I can tell you that. And so you've talked about your grandfather. What are the politics like at home?
So I would say broadly conservative, but not in a Republican way or a Tory way, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Like we're Lutheran. I was raised Lutheran, and you know, I kind of go to the church of don't be an asshole. And that's kind of what I try and teach. And I think a lot of that came from the way I was raised. You know, like my husband's family goes to like an evangelical Christian church, and like, I don't get it. Like it is, that's totally foreign to how I was brought up. So I do, like, I don't know if anybody voted for Trump in my family. I don't know. Cause like, if people don't want to talk about it, they don't. But I remember my mom having a really big fit, and I had already been in the Navy, I think. But she called and she was just so angry because my dad had told my sister, if you're not going to vote for George Bush, don't vote. And she was just raging that you don't tell somebody that, like, you never tell somebody don't bother voting unless you vote for my person. But, you know, that's the way it is. But so like my grandparents are straight ticket Democrats. And I think my other grandparents were, actually, I don't know, because I think they like to, a lot of my family like to like vote for Perot or vote for somebody else, and not really quite fit the mold. Because even though they're conservative in an open way of like, this is how we do things on the farm for generations. But, you know, less about judging others and putting, well, here, like here in Scotland, when people are religious, it implies they're trying to put their faith on others. Like where we grew up, like, if even the most religious of them are like, no, like we don't do prayer in public schools. We keep all that separate, kind of purist in that kind of way.
Mm. Well, it is a nice reminder. And it's something that I think especially a lot of Americans on the coach don't always realize, is that when you are looking at so-called red states, they ain't all created equal in terms of what exactly conservatism means. And again, I talk about this, like, I'm from Idaho, deepest red state in the country. There are two, literally two blue counties in the whole state. Okay.
My husband's yet, from Wyoming, so.
Oh yeah, right. I mean, I'm sure he's got pretty much the same. But by and large, though, the whole idea of like a religious element in Idaho conservatism, it's just not a thing. Like, you know, not in the way that you'd find it down in like Bama or Arkansas or a place like that where the evangelical vote reigns a lot more supreme. And even up in your neck of the woods, I remember, you know, I'd like your thoughts on this, but I remember in 2016 when Ted Cruz, I think, won Wisconsin, and that was actually talked about as a pretty defining moment, because the idea that someone like Ted Cruz, this very openly evangelical Republican, was somehow going to carry the vote, when historically the Republicanism of Wisconsin, Michigan, what we now I guess call the Rust Belt, was much more labor focused, and it was much more about, look, I don't care what church you go to on Sunday, you're going to protect my factory job.
I think that is a shift, and I'm not sure that shift stayed there. I think it might have shifted back, but I'm only watching it from a distance. I think the Rust Belt's more like Ohio, though. Like,
is that right?
Because, I mean, there are a lot of factories in Milwaukee, but it's more of like, it's dairy and farms, I think. So it's kind of mixed. But Wisconsin's always been kind of purple in that it could go either way, not in that it's moderate. I think you have people from all different stripes. But when Ted Cruz got elected, I think that was like in the middle of Scott Walker and Paul Ryan being, you know, like, I don't know what they were thinking, because like I didn't live there at the time and I was appalled, you know, so just appalled by that, how that all happened.
Well, you know, it's the same thing. A lot of my extended family's in Michigan, and Michigan's the same way. I mean, very purple in the sense that there actually is still quite a audience, if you will, for Democratic contenders. And yet they had Rick Snyder in there for a while. And, you know, that dude likely poisoned an American city, but that's a that's a whole other ball game that we don't got to go down there.
So now they have a lot of Democrats, but they also have somebody trying to kidnap the governor. You know what I mean? So it's not that it's just moderate. It's just that you have people from all over the spectrum mixing.
Yeah, which honestly, I think is probably the portrait of most Americans. I think the whole red state, blue state thing is often over exaggerated in the sense of like how people actually think. It's like, you know, voters are weird. Don't know if people know that. Like, you know, they split tickets all the time, right? And trying to shoehorn one way or the other ain't exactly a recipe for success, as I think many a political figure has figured out in recent years. So
very different. It's very nice to talk about this. Talk about voting in the American sense as opposed to is here, because it's very different.
Yeah.
Just like even philosophically, and like what makes people vote and what causes, it's very different.
Yeah. And I definitely want to explore that because I'm curious about your insight. But going back, so you enlisted in the Navy at 19, and of course, perfect time. And this is at the start of 2001. So 9/11, of course, was right around the corner. Nobody knew that yet. But being in the military at that time, what kinds of shifts did you see as a result of 9/11?
I mean, it was weird. It was weird. Like, I was in school. I was in training still when it happened. And I was like an aviation electrician. So I had been like in a shut room, like working on a pretend fuel cell, like trying to figure out how to measure for a fault or whatever. So I came out and one of the planes had hit already. So I walked out in between. So everybody else kind of already knew what was going on. And it's very surreal. Like, I'm sure everybody who experienced it knew, but immediately, we had to start showing our ID cards, like to get in and out of our classroom or to go in and out of the bathroom, you know, to the toilets or whatever. And like, we had to stay at school and like muster until really, really late. And it really, you kind of got this like automatic flash sense of like, oh, they just have to do this everywhere. Like, it doesn't matter if we all know each other. They've put these measures in place everywhere. And to make sure that things are locked up tight, everybody needs to do it. And so 3 weeks later, I got my orders to Bahrain, which I had to look up to figure out where it was. So 3 weeks later, I got orders to the Middle East. So I think that definitely affected my life quite a bit. I don't know if I would have gotten those orders otherwise. And then I spent 2002 to 2004 in the ramp up and in the beginning of the war in the Middle East. So, I mean, I wasn't doing combat. I was like flying around. They were remapping the area, like with the government, like, you know, in partnership with Bahrain and Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. They were redoing the map so that they were digital. And I flew around a lot of people who were involved in that, basically.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of shifts culturally did you see? I mean, because I'm thinking that this is a U.S. military that has recently found its stride again after the first Gulf War, after a few decades of really feeling demoralized from the embarrassment of the Vietnam defeat. But at the same time, I mean, say for like Kosovo, it's also been kind of on standby since the 1990s. Now this gives them a new lease on life in some ways. In what ways did you see that manifest in the culture of the military at the time?
I think that I was maybe a little bit too junior to understand, you know what I mean? To understand what had been like, what the mood was, because I had just gotten there, right? But I know a lot of people, you know, when we just pulled out of Afghanistan, who were like, you know, we never should have went there. And I was like, really? Really? Were you around then? Because I didn't really hear many voices around the world saying like, oh, this superpower got hit and they should just take it and not do anything. Because leading up to that, like Osama, like they had bombed the coal. And before that, they had bombed the World Trade Center earlier and all these things where it was kind of, just, you know, let it go, or, you know, you don't do anything major, which makes sense. But I don't think that there was any sort of political or any kind of will throughout the world to go like, oh, let's just not do anything, right? It was just like, get there, take care of it. Now, do I think we should have been there for 20 years? No. You know, but there's also, I remember being like, oh, maybe George Bush does say things that aren't wrong sometimes. I remember the speeches he gave on that day, just thinking that of like, oh, well, like, I wonder what Al Gore would have done in this situation. Like, I bet maybe he wouldn't have been able to speak as well, actually, like, which is a weird thing to say about George Bush. I know that he spoke well. But I remember people being like, I remember feeling like it was like a sort of unity of like, we're not going to let this happen to us, which unfortunately turned into like 20 years of conflict and changed the things. And I think we should learn the lessons from that. But I think a lot of the things that happened, a lot of the arguments going up to the Iraq war, I wasn't involved in. And I remember my grandparents going like, this is so horrible and we shouldn't go there. And I was like, I don't have an opinion on whether or not we should go. I just know we're going. You know, like that's all I knew, is that I lived in the Middle East. We were doing these things that it seemed like it was predetermined. But that's not to say that it was. It's just like everything feels like it's predetermined when you're in the military. Mm-hmm. That's how they do it, you know.
Well, and certainly what you're speaking to, and this is actually something that has come up. A number of commentators I listened to have pointed this out, that around the time of the Afghanistan withdrawal a few months ago, that people who were too young to understand the frenzy around going into Iraq and going into Afghanistan, they were looking at a lot of this media coverage and saying, now I get it. Like, now I understand how people could have been whipped up into that. Because if you look at, especially around the withdrawal and all the coverage and all the things about Biden's making a mistake, we should have left, but not like this, right? Because everybody becomes an armchair general around the time that it's time to do something like that. But that, and I mean, I was too young to really comprehend 9/11. I was in like third grade. Yeah, I just started. So I didn't know what the hell was going on. Just that something big had happened. My folks was talking about it. Everyone at school was talking about it. And even like seeing the events unfold for the next few years, it's just like, I don't know who like Saddam Hussein is, right? Or anything like that. But
the first Gulf War happened when I was in a third or fourth grade. So I know, yeah. I can remember and think, oh yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
Yes. It's the kind of thing where, yeah, we can look with hindsight and be like, how did this happen? Why did we even get there in the first place? It's like, well, you know, you kind of had to be there, son. And then I ain't justifying it, but the idea of the national mood being pitch perfect for something like that, it makes a lot of sense.
The international mood, like, I would love to live in a reality where 9/11 could happen and we don't retaliate and we find a different way. But I don't think we live in that reality. Like, I don't think we live in it now. If you think about that, like, I just don't. I don't see any of the big countries taking something like that and, you know, it from being from a terrorist cell that infiltrated and being like, we're cool. Like, let's just, you know. I would really like to live in that kind of reality for real. But and I saw a lot of conflation with Iraq and Afghanistan, right? When we pulled out of Afghanistan, they started talking about how unjust it was to go to Iraq. And I wanted to set that aside and say, like, these two things are two different things.
Exactly.
But here in the UK, they really, I think it's that it's hard to, like, a lot of Americans didn't want to go to war in Iraq. But over here, it's like, well, the Americans went to war and they drug us into war. Tony Blair drug us into war. And there's a lot of hatred still and just like this knee-jerk anger. And it's probably because people don't want to recognize that we were all helpless in it. You know, most of the world were helpless, like a couple of white men with a bone to pick, you know, and that wanted something causes to happen. But yeah, it's important to like remember these things as separate and like know what you're talking about before you start knee jerk armchair generally.
Well, and unfortunately, I mean, we don't got to go down this rabbit hole, but I look at the current situation with the buildup in Ukraine and I see a lot of echoes of the same thing where it's like the most belligerent talk around that conflict ain't coming from Paris. It ain't coming from Brussels. It ain't even coming from Kyiv. In fact, Kyiv is actually saying, hey, can you guys knock it off? Because you ain't helping nothing here. It's entirely driven by Washington, Moscow, and to a lesser extent, London, especially as Boris Johnson's numbers are really starting to tank. I mean, there's nothing like, as Margaret Thatcher once demonstrated, nothing like a foreign conflict to really pull you out of the icebox if you need it.
Yeah, all those Russian oligarchs that are in the House of Lords stand to make a lot of money if they also support Ukraine, you know?
Well, there is that dynamic as well. So I want to shift into when you arrived in the United Kingdom. I mean, what was the impetus for moving shop over there? And what was the state of the country when you arrived?
Right. So it was in 2016. So maybe I could just back up to like the process of deciding to move here, because Absolutely. We saved for a few years because, you know, so I was medically retired from the military. I couldn't fly anymore. And it was kind of when they were downsizing the military a lot. It was, you know, during Obama, all of this, you know, so I think it was like 2013, I was medically retired. And I was pregnant with my daughter. So I have a son and daughter. And we kind of realized there's all these active shooter drills that they were doing. Like, not only were they in private schools and public schools, not only were they given to five-year-olds, like, I'm like, I would have to homeschool our kids to not have them go through that. And like, that was when they first started doing them like that, they were trying to make them traumatic. They were making them as realistic as possible instead of like just teaching kids where to go. And I, you know, my background is in, I study politics now, but I was doing research psychology before this. And I just kind of knew how bad it was. And, you know, I didn't really think, you don't think you're sending your kids into school where there's a risk of like actually getting shot, but there is a risk of that. And we kind of figured out, my husband's a veteran as well. And we're like, oh, the GI Bill from the Navy pays for overseas school. Let's save some money. Let's see where they accept us and let's start looking. And Scotland had good schools. They complain about schools here a lot, but they're really quite amazing. Compared to like some places in America where we would have sent our kids to school. So we started saving our money, and it was like around the referendum. Maybe we should pay attention to the BBC and everything. And all of a sudden the independence referendum, like, oh God, we just narrowed it down and decided Scotland's where we're moving. Like, hopefully we can still move there. And, you know, kind of listening, going, oh yeah, like they should be independent if they want, you know, kind of thing. So then saved up money, got accepted to University of Edinburgh. I had to finish up my bachelor's degree quickly so I could do my master's over here. Moved here like right when my son was five and starting P1, and right after the Brexit vote. I think I landed here when the day Theresa May became president. I mean, PM, sorry, president. Oh, God forbid. No, the day she was announced as PM, I landed to go house hunting.
Great. What a time to touch you down. Well, we're definitely going to move in that direction next. That's going to be on our next segment, is when Cat and Company finally get across the pond. So this is World Beat. We'll be right back. Welcome back to World Beat. I am George Collins. Remind you, we are talking with Kat Carey. So, Kat, when we left off, you had just arrived in the United Kingdom. Theresa May has just gotten the Golden Throne. And coming from stateside and knowing and witnessing what you did about American politics, I'm curious for your insight. As you became more involved with UK politics, not just like in an official capacity, but just as a consumer, what were some of the differences, maybe even similarities that you see between the two systems, not necessarily in terms of like civic practice or anything, but just in terms of political culture? We touched on a little bit in part one about the way people think about partisan voting and things like that. What are some of your biggest takeaways?
Some of my biggest takeaways are that, so I moved here about the same time that if you couldn't tell, I'm an NPR person. I do like listening to NPR. So their London correspondent kind of moved over in 2016, and I've gotten to meet with him once, and we've kind of talked about politics, and it's so different in the UK compared to Scotland, because even though I didn't really get very immersed in politics, like I didn't dive straight in. You kind of get consent, right, from the people around you that like, no, your voice matters. Well, that doesn't exist down in London, but that exists up here in Scotland, where, you know, it was very, I mean, I remember kind of watching the 2017 election going, oh, well, like, what do you do here? Like, I think I would vote for a party that supports independence, but like, is Labour against independence, you know? And that wasn't the main thing. It was all about Brexit. You kind of, that was the issue in that 2017 election. I remember I was in school with, cause you know, these ancient universities are like the Ivy Leagues almost. So there's like this lady who is a Tory, and she goes, well, you know, the Tories are just like the Democratic Party. And I was like, are they now? And, you know, just trying to fit that in my head of how do these things, like, because Tory conservative is not the same as Republican conservative. And are they either of them conservatives up to, for debate? But I think that the Tories kind of take like the soulless corporate centrism of the Democrats that are in the very center to right of the Democratic Party. And like the absolute, so like Kyrsten Sinema, Joe Manchin, and like to lesser, like Nancy Pelosi, like some of the ones that aren't as bad, right? I mean, yeah, whatever. And then you take like the nastiness of the Republican Party. You take like the Jim Jordan and like those kind of guys, and just how nasty and like, ha ha, we can get our way. And the Ted Cruz's, like you take that, that to me is the Tory party. Mm-hmm. They're not quite as actually conservative, but they're really nasty and soulless.
Well, and this actually brings to mind something, and I think I brought this up when I talked to Neil Scott as well. I remember a fascinating article in The Guardian. I think it was about 3 years ago. It was right around the time that Boris Johnson was in the running for prime minister, when it was like him and Jeremy Hunt, which I remember looking at and thinking, oh man, that if that's the best that you guys got to vote on, I'm filled with sympathy. But it was a whole piece about how these Oxford, Cambridge, and even before that, this boarding school system that a lot of these elite kids end up going into, and then that pipeline goes right into politics, and how, okay, I'll put it this way. I remember when I started around the time I joined Ungagged, of course, I wanted to get more informed about UK politics for obvious reasons. And so I remember watching parliamentary meetings and things like that. And the first thing I thought of is I listened to it, and there's all this jeering, there's all this shouting, you know, people are talking shit from the peanut gallery. And after I read that, I was just like, damn, this is a total sea change. And then I read that article and I'm like, God damn, that's what this is. Like this sounds like a schoolyard right about now. And, you know, the Tories especially representing that, it makes a lot of sense. And I remember, you know, people would draw comparisons between Donald Trump and Boris Johnson, but I gotta be honest, I'm not actually sure how much that holds up. Maybe in some respects, but it's like Donald Trump at least tried to appear like an everyman, at least in the campaign. I think once he got into office, I mean, he governed like a pretty straight Republican, if you ask me. Boris Johnson don't even try that. Like, Boris Johnson doesn't even try to, like, con the working class. It's very obvious who he is. And that just seems to be a streak that runs in a lot of the Tory leadership.
There's no checks and balances, really. Imagine Trump without checks and balances. Just, you know, that's how the system is here. I mean, in America, for all its faults, the Constitution was designed to not be the British system, which has not changed that much, honestly.
I don't know. It's like it either hasn't changed much, or the fact that they have to kind of make things up as they go along because there isn't an enshrined standard might mean it changes every damn day.
Yeah. Yeah. Like the Constitution is a flawed It's a flawed document, but like everything's going to be flawed. Like it's actually pretty decent to last this long. And, you know, obviously, like, I'd like to see some new amendments come through and things like that. But yeah, this constitutionalist system is for the birds. Like it's no good. And then like we were talking about how the Tories map on in America. Well, like Labor, I always, you know, you're kind of a lefty in America and you think, oh, I'll be in Labor, right? That's my team. That's my family, right? And it's not. Like it's not. It's as much as socialism is still less of a, like it's been more of an institution here that's been allowed and not as much vilified. It's been branded and like packaged, and people can be socially conservative socialists, which it took me a while to wrap my mind around that, because you have to kind of be open minded to be even call yourself a socialist in America. So people are usually very socially liberal and socialist. And when you say you're socialist, you kind of wrap that all in there. But Labor is like, I mean, I just think of it as like the union boss of the police, the union boss of the teachers, and the union boss of like Teamsters, whatever, like if they had a party. And are they in it for themselves, or are they in it for the workers, or are they in it to keep themselves in a job? Like that's what Labor is to me. Mm-hmm. That's my quick take on that.
Well, and then there's, I remember the Lib Dems were something for like a couple minutes in the 2019 elections. But no, I actually remember, I legitimately asked, I can't remember who it was. Maybe I just posted it like in a comment thread somewhere. I was like, can someone explain to me like what the point of the Lib Dems is? Because and it was a genuine question. I legitimately did not know who this party was supposed to serve at the time. And I did get an answer that I guess at one point they actually meant something, but now they just kind of like are guys who are there and they can be voted for.
Well, it's almost like it's people who can't bring themselves to vote Tory. And like, maybe they aren't like socially conservative, like the liberal Democrats are more like socially liberal and like, we're open, but a lot of it's performative. When I think of performative wokeness, I think of the Lib Dems. I think of a bunch of white guys who like to go to the pub, who like to go out like, no, come join us. Everybody's welcome. But then like only if they get to be in charge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's kind of like the woke HR department until you start mentioning unions, and then all that's going to go out the window, isn't it?
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. And it's interesting in the difference between Scottish Lib Dems and UK Lib Dems. And, you know, their party kind of swelled in numbers from Brexit and then kind of fumbled it. So like they've kind of had two, you know, they were in the coalition, which was bad. It was a bad idea. They did bad things. You know, it killed the party. And then Brexit somewhat revived them. But like they've had somebody who's like a knight be the leader two out of the last three, you know. Why? I don't get that. I mean, don't get me started on the aristocracy. I could go off about the aristocracy.
Now, and then turn into Scotland. That same article made a point that you look at someone like Nicola Sturgeon, who ain't cut from the Oxford-Cambridge cloth, right? I guess Oxbridge is the term they use for that. Mm-hmm. And you can see it just even in the way she give speeches, the way she conducts herself. It's like, look, regardless of what you think of her, there's a very clear difference between what goes on here and what goes on down in Westminster. What has been your evaluation of Scottish politics, especially as it differs from those down in like London and what comes out of there?
I think it's very, very different. Although there's still like a hangover or like this cultural memory that some things are very British in the way that they do things. They also design and like this is like Labour and, you know, that was a big player in designing this devolved parliament to not be exactly like Westminster. If anybody knows about the like the European Parliament in Brussels, to me, it seems like kind of a mixture of the European Parliament and like filled with like the memory of British people, I guess. But it's different. It's really, I pay more attention to Holyrood than I do to Westminster because, you know, it really hit home that, you know, Scotland couldn't veto Brexit. So Scotland can't, it can vote all one way and it really doesn't affect whatever is going to happen. It's kind of like in the U.S. when people go, why does Wyoming have two senators? And you go, because look at what happens to Scotland in the U.K. You can't just base stuff solely on your population, right? All these things are imperfect. And it doesn't really, giving Wyoming that much say doesn't always turn out in my way of thinking, usually ideologically. But, you know, here, I mean, Nicola Sturgeon has done everything with at least one hand tied behind her back. And I think that's what brings Scottish politics to another level. I think that's why it's so good, because to make an argument that you should break away, you have to be better. You can't be lazy. You can't like take the shortcuts that they take and they get away with, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. And when do you start to become more involved in the Scottish political scene?
I remember watching the election and like I said, in 2017 and going, oh, it's over already. It's like the polls close and then it was over. It was very interesting. In 2018, and I think back to it, like a lot of the people that I hung out with weren't overtly political, but always were like, well, yeah, I'd vote for independence if it happened. But a lot of people didn't talk about it, right? Well, a friend of ours was like, come to this independence march with us. And we're like, well, yeah, our kids are Scottish, right? Like, they're growing up here. We want to stay here. So yeah, maybe we should go. And when we went there, that's where people started going like, no. Like, it's not like that here. It's not like in America or down south where you have to be a citizen and then maybe we'll let you have a say. You have a say right now. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of it was like, oh, if you agree on independence, like we want you to speak out about it, which is smart and it's fair. But that really is the thing here is like, I was able to vote in the last election at Holyrood. I'm still on a visa, but being able to vote is kind of put your money where your mouth is, right? Refugees can vote here and everything. I don't really know where I was going. Oh, so that's how I started getting involved with grassroots. Yes, things. I didn't join the Democrats until I moved to Scotland. That's fun fact, because I always lived in a state where there was open primaries. So I never really saw the need. Like I volunteered for the Bernie Sanders campaign. I don't know if that's a surprise to anybody, and probably not here. Like just way, way out on the left in America, where I didn't really think the Democrats represented me very much. But state residency is Florida. So that's where my grandparents live. So I had to register as a Democrat. So it took me a really long time to agree to join a political party here. And you know, you hear it's the Scottish National Party. It's not nationalist, even though in the UK, they'll say that all the time just to like make people go, oh, I don't want to be a part of that.
Yeah. It's one of those, it's one of them BBC lines, right? Because nationalist is such a dirty word. And it's like, which I don't even know that it is, because it's like, well, look, would we call like Palestinian nationalism like bad? You know, or Vietnamese back in 1960s. And I'll let you finish your point, but there are reasons why I think that Scottish Nationalist Party ain't the worst thing. But sorry, keep going.
Yeah, no problem. I do think that the only term, like only context I'd ever heard nationalists growing up or like really in my life before moving here was like the KKK, like white nationalists. You know what I mean? Or like, or that, like, I think the Black Panthers were Black nationalists, right? I'm not sure if they were or not. But, like, that's what I thought of immediately, the KKK. I'm like, oh, God, no. Like, I can't do this. And it took me a really long time to be able to, like, put in my head, you know, like, my friend who's from Portugal, he's like, well, I'm not a nationalist. I'm in the SP, but you don't have to be nationalist. You just do what you want, you know? Like, stop worrying about the labels. And, you know, living in a different country and living in a different system and studying the politics of that system, you start to realize that words don't really matter anymore. So it was a combination of like grassroots. Yes, is very repetitive and it's repetitive on purpose. Like you have to campaign, you have to say the same things over and over, but I was getting bored. I was just bored and I wanted to be able to like contribute in some way. And a few of my friends had been asking me and like, no, just join the local branch and like you can go do this or that, and at least you have something to do. So I joined right at the beginning of the pandemic, like January, February 2020 is when I joined the SNP. And my husband joined the Scottish Greens for a while, but I can't say that I disagree. Like, I like the politics of the Scottish Greens, but I'm used to being in a big, huge party with a bunch of people I disagree with, if that makes sense. The Scottish Greens is a small party who they agree on almost everything. The thing is that you start arguing nuance very, very strenuously with all the people you're around. And like, we have all the centrist dads that need somebody who have the patience of being a lefty in America and talking to people who, you know, try to make them see that it's not, you know, the devil. Yeah, I feel like there's a place for me here, and that I wouldn't say I'm needed in a way that, like, that seems a little bit too hubristic. Am I a part or something? You know what I mean? Like, but I feel like there's something for me to do in SNP.
And what I'm thinking about, you know, as you come into this leadership role and gotten more acquainted with the political system, role does Scotland play in UK politics? I know that's a broad question, but the thing that's been really fascinating for me as someone looking from the outside is I look at Brexit, and I don't actually think that Brexit exposed anything new. I think it just broke open some fissures that have always been there in the UK and that were just paved over for so long. Because, you know, if all you watched was the BBC, you'd think that, oh, yeah, everybody's just one happy family. Yeah, sure, we fight, but everybody does, right? No, I mean, from everything I've understood, there's always been quite a bit of enmity in not just Scotland, but, you know, Northern Ireland, Wales, you know, these are places that have that too. Actually, one of my good friends, he from the UK, moved out here for a little while. Now he's back over there. And he once told me, he was like, man, if I'm like in Cardiff, I do not go into the pubs. Because as soon as someone hears me talk, it's on. You know what I mean? So I've always like looked at the way that these different areas have to interact with each other. And they all play their very pivotal roles, even if it is some teeth-clenched teamwork at times. What is Scotland's role? And what exactly does it add to UK politics?
I think, like, historically, Scotland's always been kind of like a piggy bank, like both an intellectual and an economical piggy bank for the British system. So even, you know, back in the day of the Scottish Enlightenment, right? Like, they owned that, right? Or owned a piece of it. Just like the clearances, like, there was the great clearances, right? And all these things, but there's all been different iterations of clearances since then. Just to, you know, you think about how the oil, like drilling for more oil, that's not something Scotland wants. And it's in Scottish waters, but it's in British waters. So all of these kind of things are completely out of the hands of people who live here and live on the economy. There's a lot of, I just see like there's a definite difference in values and how people live those values. I think there's a lot of people in England who are unhappy with the system and have good values and everything. But what I try and always say is like, I think like Scotland being independent would help you fix it. How are you going to fix it right now? Like, that's what I can't see is and like, if you think about how like Gordon Brown or how Tony Blair's like chief advisor, they're both Scottish. Usually the best and the brightest from Scotland would go down and make their name in Westminster or they go down to London. And I think there's a big push to not be like that anymore and to keep talent here.
And along with that, I think about post Brexit, which if nothing else, even the most ardent, I can't remember the term that Neil used for him. No campaigner, I guess. I mean, the folks who were really wedded to the idea of Scotland remaining in the United Kingdom got real hard to deny this connection after Brexit, when Scotland votes overwhelmingly to stay in the EU and the UK just is like, fuck you, pretty much. What kind of realignment has that brought about in Scottish politics, not just around the independence question, but just in general? Like, what kinds of changes does something that seismic bring?
Well, I can say that, like, it's made, because I'm a newcomer, right? I wasn't like Neil said, what, 2001 he started campaigning for independence, or was it 2011?
So something like that. That dude's been campaigning since he could walk, man. I don't even know.
Sounds like it, yeah. And I was opinionated since I could walk. I wasn't always necessarily politically opinionated, but I came a little bit later to the game, and I see people that are so impatient, and they see independence as like a goal. And a lot of those people aren't happy. Like they're not unhappy is not the right way to put it, because like they can't see that the pandemic is not like a ripe environment to win a referendum, right? You can't run a referendum during a pandemic, because not when you don't have the power of the media, not when you don't have all the money, the monetary, the fiscal stuff, that people will vote no just because of that. So there's a sense of urgency. I think like it's matured in certain ways, is that there are the people who want to see more urgency, but like there was a breakaway party that kind of formed with Alex Salmond. That's mostly people that are like, we want to just do this and we don't care about reality. And really, I don't agree with them, but you need that, right? Like for progress, you need the people you don't agree with to be doing their thing, to exert pressure in a different way, right? The Scottish Greens are a lot more on the left than the SNP, and they're like pulling to the left. And while some of us from the inside are pushing to the left, I think competence has been valued for a long time. And sometimes that's at the detriment of like everything, because sometimes I think it's like, what's the safe thing to do is the way that things are, you know, maybe that's all governments, but like there's been a bit of a hesitance. So like the independence movement has kept gaining strength and like maturity, I think. I think that the unionist parties really struggle. Like the Lib Dems, there's hardly any representatives from Scotland. And they're really from like the islands, from the Shetlands and the Orkneys, where they just are different, right? Just like different parts of the US are different. Shetland and the Orkneys are different. And the Lib Dems up there are different than the Lib Dems from like Edinburgh. Scottish Labour is very split. Like there are socialists in Labour and there's the centrists, and they kind of have their divisions doing that. And the Scottish Tories, they sit there and they rail about how people need like longer, stronger prison sentences and things like that, you know, that you're just like, they're like, they want everything open for everyone always. They don't want any pandemic restrictions because they don't want to hurt businesses. And who cares if people die? Because that's what conservatives think, right? Like, so I don't know if that answered your question at all.
Oh, it did. And it also makes me think, alluding to something that you talked about earlier, I wonder if one of the challenges that some pro-independence forces have is the fact that a lot of the sharpest political minds do ship down to London and do end up working in posts in Westminster, which isn't to say that there ain't competence in who remains. I mean, of course there is. But it also means that when it comes to things like, how do you frame a pro-independence message, not just in a pandemic, but also... maybe this ain't as much of a factor now, but I remember about 3 or 4 years ago and talking to interviewing some folks who had actually campaigned for independence from the outside of the country. And they said, you know, as much as Brexit really, I think, spurred on the cause, it's not the time for a referendum just because of political fatigue. You know, this is like 2018, the 2017 election has happened. We're around the corner from all these snap elections. You know, Brexit ain't that far in the rearview mirror. And being able to navigate that and being able to come up with politically savvy ways to do that, that takes a lot of a lot of experience, a lot of knife sharpening doing that. And if your people who are best suited to do that ain't staying in the country, in a way, it's almost like a political brain drain, and that makes that even more difficult in my mind.
Yeah, I think if you look at the people that are at the top of the different parties down in Westminster, they used to have a lot more Scottish people on the benches, whereas now there's a lot of people from the SNP in Westminster, right, that are elected. And even then, some independence supporters are like, we shouldn't be in Westminster. We should be like Sinn Féin and refuse to take our seat, which I don't actually agree with. I think that you'd have to campaign on that and get elected on that to not sit personally. like consent from the people who voted for you. But I do think like some people like, oh, they're just, you know, warming their feet down at Westminster. Like I know a couple MPs that would, that, you know, they're dying to get to Scotland and to get out of Westminster, job or no job. But, you know, that's going to be, it's going to be a great day when we get to pull out of there, I think.
Yeah, and we're going to come back to that. So stick with us. We'll be right back with World Beat.